This episode is brought to you by Ticker. Ticker.com is focused on bringing institutional-level investment research to you, the individual investor. Ticker.com is powered by S&P Global Capital IQ and has coverage of over 50,000 stocks globally with financial data, estimates, valuation metrics, ownership percentages, transcript filings, news, and more. Value Hive listeners can join Ticker's free beta trial today at ticker.com/hive. That's TIKR.com/hive.
One. All right. Alex Barrow, co-founder of MacroOps. If that name sounds familiar, it's because that's what this podcast is. It's the MacroOps Value Hive podcast. And Alex and I tag team all the research, both premium and freemium, on the website. And our job with MacroOps is just to find the best companies trading at crazy prices and figuring out how to navigate these wild markets. And Alex's background is really unique. He is a former Marine Scout sniper, self-taught all knowledge that he has about the markets. He's had some insanely great times. He's had some insanely poor times where he's lost a lot of money and learned a lot of lessons along the way. And he's got a crazy mic contraption that I'm staring at right now. So he's obviously a noob to the podcast game, but that's all going to change after today. So Alex, my right-hand man at MacroOps, how you doing?
I'm doing good, Brent. Thanks for having me on. It's great. It's an honor to be on my favorite podcast. So, I mean, you've been running this thing for over a year now, and you're just now inviting me on. That's
well, I saved the best.
Very kind of you.
I save the best guests for last.
And Brandon's like talking. So. I got this. But, my buddy gave me this giant arm contraption that's sticking out of my desk and basically hitting me in the face that I'm talking in this mic. So let's see how this works. But
I can't even see your face. So that's an added bonus.
No, it really is. That's what I use it for.
All right. So take us back to, you know, obviously not all the way back, but there was a time before markets where you probably had no idea that you wanted to be, you know, a trader, speculator, investor. Where was that time? And talk to us about your time spent in the military.
Sure. Yeah. So it's kind of an eclectic background. And it goes back, I first got introduced in markets when I was 12, 13 years old. My dad's a CPA. He was a partner at Arthur Andersen. May she rest in peace. He's always kind of just been a punter in the markets, an investor. So he had all the market, Jack Swagger, Market Wizards books, the Ben Graham books on the bookshelves. And I remember in the late 90s, when I was in my teenage years, he got me buying some telecom stocks and stuff. And I was like, oh, this is interesting, you know, but I was more interested in just surfing and skateboarding and skipping out on school and stuff. So it didn't really catch on. But I graduated high school early. So I was in college at 17. And then 9/11 happened. And I was just kind of a wayward, wild child, I guess you could say. And so I was looking for structure, and I ended up going into the Marine Corps. Like a month after 9/11, I walked into recruiter's office and I was like, hey, I want to kill terrorists. And, you know, his face lit up and he's like, sign right here, let's get you in. And I was like, all right. I had no idea what I was doing. Regretted it when I ended up in boot camp, got my ass kicked. But ended up being really good. I spent 4 years there. After that, I went into Army National Guard for 6 years doing human intelligence collection, interrogation. Spent some time I got my degree at UC Davis studying political science. And then somewhere along that time, immediately after I got out of, I've been like kind of involved in stocks, you know, in markets, just like passively, you know, just, it was right. Like a passing interest. Right. And when I got out of the Marine Corps and I was in college, I started getting really into trading. I was, you know, just messing around with stuff, trying to find what I was into. But I was still doing other stuff. Like I was working as a bodyguard to pay my way through school. I really enjoyed markets, but for me, like a career in markets wasn't even in the realm of possibilities, right? I didn't go to an Ivy League school. I didn't know a lot of people who worked in that area and stuff. So it was really interesting to me. I think it was Jack Swagger, the original Market Wizards book, that and Pitbull by Marty Schwartz. Those were the two first trading books that I read where I was like, oh, wow. So it's like, you know, you don't have to be a Harvard grad to play this game. You just got to be kind of, you know, you got to be a hustler, self-learner and stuff, and like really just grind away. And right. So it was after reading one of those books that I started getting a little bit more serious, but I was still at that time, I think I was planning on getting in a career in full-time just in intelligence, working for the CIA. That was my goal. And so I was doing that. I was on that path. And then I don't know, after 6 years of working in various contracting intelligence jobs, I started to get a little burned out and I started to get really into trading. I'm an OCD, like excessive compulsive type person, right? So when I get into something, it becomes all consuming. That's the only thing that matters in my life. And, you know, so I've gone through different stages, you know, and usually these things will last like 6 months to a year and then I'll run out. So I'm a jack of all trades, master of few. Right. But trading was something that, I don't know, my early 20s began to stick. And I was like, man, this is like, it just became everything to me. So I started trading a lot, blowing up a number of accounts. I would, you know, I remember cold calling Jack Swagger because I thought, you know, he could give me the secrets, and he was like graciously enough to entertain me, you know, for a while on the phone.
So he actually contacted you?
Oh yeah. Yeah. No, wow. No. I mean, surprisingly easy to get a hold of a lot of these guys. So I started doing that. I started cold calling a lot of hedge fund guys. And I was just like, you know, because at that early stage, I think everybody goes through this. You're like, oh, I think there's a secret to playing this game. Right. So, you know, you read the hedge fund market wizards books and, you know, it's the same, you know, adages. It was given like, oh, well, cut your losers short, you know, let your winners run. And you're like, okay, well, duh. Yeah. But like, how, you know, what's your secret? You know? And so I was still chasing that, thinking that there is a secret, you know, cold calling all those guys. Let's see. I don't know. At some point I took a DIA contract working over in Afghanistan because this was back in the early days of contracting in war zones and you got paid a ton of money. So I went over there doing intelligence work, but this was back in 2012. And I lugged this. I remember lugging this giant trunk filled with, I don't know, it was like 60 trading books, trading investing books, like over to Afghanistan with me. And people are like, what the hell are you doing, man? Like, you know,
becoming the next market wizard, obviously.
Yeah. Cause that was my goal. So I'm like, I'm going to go over to Afghanistan for a year, make some good money, build up a trading stake. You know, I'm just going to keep studying the game and I'm going to be able to come back and start a hedge fund. And, you know, and then I'm going to be featured in Swagger's next book. And that was the plan. So I was over there, you know, I was working 12-hour days, 7 days a week, living in this little trailer in the middle of Helmand province, southern Afghanistan. And after work, I'd come back to my trailer. I had a little satellite dish where I'd get hooked up to the internet. I'd, you know, trade some of the markets when they're open, and I'd study. You know, I'd sleep like 4 hours a night. I just did that for almost a year. And then I left that. I traveled the world for a year and a half, and I came back and I took my trading stake and I sat down to like trade it seriously. And then over the course of 6 to 12 months, I had an insane run. I remember.
Break it down for us. Like, let's get into this insane run here.
Yeah. So it was just an insane run for somebody who was just getting like really, really serious about the game.
Yeah.
You know, after blowing up some small accounts, just being a speculative piker and stuff. So anyway, like, yeah, by this time it was, 2013 or 2014. So you had started to have some big moves in oil, in the dollar yen cross. And I happened to catch almost every single one of these and then start pyramiding on them. And I was just, you know, I was making, it was over a triple digit return in less than 6 months, you know, on a sizable trading stake for somebody who's in their late 20s, right? Or at least for me, it was. Yeah. And I was like, oh my God, you know, I'm blowing, you know, all my idols out of the water as far as, you know, returns are considered. And I really thought, and it went straight to my head, like something that I never thought would happen because, you know, I'm a cold calculating professional. I'm not an emotional guy by nature, but man, it's like my ego inflated and it was freaking size of a blimp. And I just wasn't aware of it. And then I just started to get sloppy, started to, you know, I had these amazing trends that I was just fortunate enough to catch, like right when I got back and started trading seriously, started to turn. And so the easy money was no longer to be made. And then I started losing and started revenge trading. And then I lost almost everything. And it was at that point, which is probably, it was very painful. It was 6 months where I was like, man, it was, I got kicked in the teeth and I was down. I was like, I'm not sure if I'm cut out for this. It was really painful. I'd never had that much money in my life. And I lost it all in the span of, 6 to 9 months. We're talking like
six figures, just to kind of get a scope of this, because I think dollar wise, they always say that, losing a dollar hurts three times as much as gaining a dollar or something like that. And so I've noticed that grows exponentially, even though percentages might still be the same. But I mean, how much did you run it up and then how much did you give back?
Yeah. So I ran it up to, it was a couple $100,000 at the peak. And then I lost about 75% of it. Over the course of six to nine months. And so it wasn't even like, it was about the money. It wasn't because I was never interested in this game about the money. I've always been kind of, that's never a driving force for me. I'm a simple guy. I don't have expensive tastes and I don't care for a lot of that stuff. It's just the game, right? And the money is, that's the scoreboard. And I lost like that. And it was worse because I thought that I was totally impervious to that type of stuff. To revenge trading and, cause I'd blown up accounts and stuff numerous times, but just because I didn't know what I was doing. Yeah. And by that point, I'd been trading pretty seriously for a number of years. I knew what I was doing and I made that money, one, because the markets were in some great trends and I nailed them correctly. And I had really good, up until a certain point, really good risk and trade management and a good process I've been proven out over a number of years. But when I went all in. And when I started to not have that same level of performance over a couple months, I just, my process went out the fucking window. And then I paid the price, right? But
yeah,
it was an amazing learning experience, just expensive cost of tuition right in the game. From there, let's see, I went to work for a small market macro research firm where I learned, some good stuff, but also, that was an interesting time. I'm not gonna talk about that. I worked for a small fund. I interned with, or not interned, but I seeked out mentors, some really good traders that I just like, hold on, I got IB Interactive Broker speaking into my ear.
He's always on, Alex Barrow.
you gotta be plugged in.
you had these mentors, and how did you find these people in the first place? Because this was probably the dawn of Twitter, early days of Twitter. So it's not like it is now, where people that are listening in 2021 think, oh, you just hop in somebody's DM and say, hey, I want to be your mentor.
Oh man, I mean, if only Twitter was around then, that would have been amazing. No, I just I just did it the old-fashioned way. I would network. I would call up people that I know, family, friends who might know people, and ask for introductions. I would cold call people, show up physically at hedge funds, knock on doors, and ask to speak to people. I moved to New York City because I thought that's where you had to be a trader.
Wow! And so you uprooted yourself just to go and have that shot.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, it was the only thing that mattered to me. Total OCD compulsive. Like this was it. It was 7 days a week. And I was like, I'm going to make it somehow, that's what I did. So I was able, fortunate enough to get some really high quality mentors I just learned a lot from. I probably can't share their names, but really good people that were, gracious enough to share a lot of their time and their wisdom with me. And that was super, super helpful. So after that, I started to get my groove back, hard code a better process. And so I can never let myself get to that spot again, where I, given away all that money, let my ego drive my trading decisions.
Yeah.
At some point, in 2015, I got a, was it 2015, I believe. Yeah, I got a job offer at Bridgewater, which at the time was my dream job. And we went through a multi-week hiring process, which was real interesting, spent a lot of time there. I took the job offer, had moved out there, was in the process of moving out there to start there. They put you through the like little boot camp thing the last
few months. A boot camp or is it like a cult indoctrination ceremony? I don't know which
that
one
that yeah, that's true. It's actually a cult indoctrination. I mean, there's, you know,
is it actually drink. As I'm not going to say bad because I've never been part of that type of, call it a fraternity if you want, I guess, but was it as bad as some of the articles that ended up coming out?
I don't know. I mean, I spent a decent amount of time there and getting to know some of the people and sitting in on their meetings and stuff. So, you know, from what I saw, I was super impressed. It's like I read a lot of those hit pieces, but they're just hit pieces. It's media trying to get clicks. Right. Yeah. But I'm sure, you know, it's a big organization. There's over 1500 people. Is there some weird stuff going on? I'm sure, you know,
without a doubt.
But yeah, I mean, my time there, I love the culture. I love the culture. I love the radical transparency. People just speaking their mind, you know, it doesn't matter. There's like, as far as hierarchy goes, that was, man, I thought that was amazing. So I was super stoked to start there, but I started to get a little cold feet shortly before I was ready to start, because one, I was a junior management role. So I was going to I was going to be running a lot of meetings, you know. It's a big machine. So you're just a small cog in this big machine, which would have been a great, amazing learning opportunity. But I would have just been sitting in meetings doing they do a lot of meetings there, and I can't stay in meetings. I just can't do it. I'm not a meetings guy. So I had always wanted to do my own thing. And I didn't really know what that was. Like when I was really doing Intel stuff, I toyed around with starting this counterterrorism site called Threat Intel. This was like way back in the
day. No way.
Before like blogging like was real popular and stuff. And so I was toying around with that and making that because I was really into counterterrorism at the time. And so I just got the idea of doing, you know, making a site. And so I called up two of my old buddies that I worked at this former macro research firm, AK and TK. And, you know, I was like, no, you guys want to do this? Like, just, you know, quit our jobs, you know, I'm going to turn down this, my dream job. And so we can start a blog and we'll give it, and we're going to give it, you know, 18 months and we'll just see what can happen. And we were all, you know, I guess like young and dumb enough to do it. And so I moved to DC and I took a contract job working at the FBI at the time, doing similar counterintel work, just to pay the bills. And so I worked there in regular 9-to-5 job. And then I would come back and I'd work, you know, nights and weekends on macro stuff. And AK and TK would just work full time. And so, yeah, really what we wanted to create was just a website that we wanted, but didn't exist at the time, which was just a site dedicated to like really serious study of trading and investing. And so I just wanted to scratch my own itch. And that's kind of what we set out to do. We didn't know exactly what that would look like. And it's changed a ton over the years. I've always been a big fan of virtual commodities or the Commodities Corp story, right? You know, Amos Hostetter and those guys started Commodities Corp way back in the day. And that's, you produced like some of the greats like Bruce Kovner, Paul Tudor Jones, you know, the list goes on. And it's just amazing because they had this really just amazing group of people that seem to be attracted to this place because they're doing something unique. And then they shared ideas. They all like mentored each other and they worked at the same goal, which is like just constant, you know, improvement and study at the game. And, you know, and they had amazing results because of it. Right.
Yeah.
And so there is no Commodities Corp today. Right. But I was like, oh, you know, like maybe you could do that somewhat on a virtual level. And, you know, and because I was just like, I don't consider myself particularly gifted in any way, like physically, intellectually, you know, I'm pretty average. But what I am good at and what's allowed me to excel at a lot of things that I've done is that I'm maniacal about stuff and I will like go all in on things. But two is like, I'm really good at searching out best performers and stuff. And then just taking them apart, you know, dissecting them, like studying them, everything that they do, and then taking that in and having an open mind to go and study another top performer who has a totally different approach.
Yeah.
And so that's always been my bread and butter. And so I wanted to create, you know, a group of traders and investors with all different styles, who are just fanatical about the game, love the game, and want to play it to the best of their abilities. And I wanted to get them all together so I could learn from them. Right. And, yeah. you know, so the only way I could do that is by, you know, putting out like really good quality research, that's kind of higher end, that then naturally filters out a lot of the speculative lower end retail crowd that's looking for the, you know, get rich quick schemes. And so, yeah, that's what we started to do. And, you know, it was a slow going. We've kind of, you know, course a bunch of times and, you know, and that's been five, we're going into our fifth year. Yeah. Fifth year now. I mean, it's crazy. Yeah, a little over 5 years, which is nuts. Yeah. We've come a long ways. I mean, the group's grown a ton. The collective is, I'm just like, every day I'm excited. I'm super humbled by the group of operators we have in our, you know, in our community. It's amazing. I mean, like guys that are so much smarter than I am. you know, it's just amazing that we get to, you know, serve them and, you know, interact with them and stuff. And it's made me such a better trader as a result, which is, you know, was the initial goal. And hopefully, like, you know, our work that we do helps them in turn, which it seems to do. I mean, everybody seems really happy with it. So that's kind of, you know, that's my genesis story.
Yeah. There's a lot right to unpack there. And I've written down a few things that I'm inevitably going to pull back and go back to some earlier topics before we jump back forward, kind of like a Tenet style movie, jump back into the present.
I just started watching that movie like literally 2 days ago and I stopped halfway. And I'm like, I have no idea what's going on. And
the problem is you stopped halfway. What you needed to do is watch the whole thing and then watch it again. That's watch it twice. And then go to YouTube and watch all of it explained by some really cool British dude that breaks it down in a way that you can't understand.
You know, because a friend recommended to my girlfriend and I was like, oh, you know, they're like, you got to watch this. And I'm like, well, I heard it's really confusing. I'm a big Christopher Nolan fan. I'm like,
I love Christopher Nolan.
Yeah, I do too. And they're like, it is confusing. You're not going to know what's going on, but you have to go and watch all these explanatory videos afterwards. And I was like, ah, okay. Well, then it just kind of sounds like a crappy movie.
Yeah. So, okay. So that, yeah. So then we're going to kind of invert this and go back a little bit. There's two things that I mentioned about because you did a lot of interesting non-trading related work. And the two things I want to focus on is the first, what kind of protection/detail bodyguard work did you do? Was it any high profile people? And do you have any kind of funny stories about that? Cause I think that's just something that's scratching my own itch. Right. And then the second part is the benefit of working those 12-hour days in tangent with developing a trading style that is robust. And we'll get to that second part later. But the first part, did you have any really cool bodyguard experiences where you're, you know, trying to protect these high profile people?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Yeah. Cause I did that off and on for a number of years. I have a lot of stories, man, about that. My first day on the job, and I kind of fell into it. One of my former Marine buddies had been doing it, and he called me up there. They needed somebody on a team to run this, you know, a short-term gig. And he's like, hey, Alex, you know, I know you're in the area. This is when I was down in LA. And would you be interested in doing this? They pay, you know, good money. It was like $500 a day. And I was like, yeah, I'm sure I'm not. You know, I was at that time, I was training to I think I was training to go back in the military for the Navy SEALs. I was going to try out for the Navy SEALs. And so I had a bunch of time. I was like, sure, you know, I'll do it. And I show up and it was at this hospital. This guy, he was a gems dealer. So he dealt in like diamonds, an international gems dealer. He was an Afghani immigrant and a really interesting guy, but he lived in LA, very, very, very wealthy, very connected. Well, anyways, he was in the hospital with his fiance because he had been kidnapped by some Iranian mafia, which they have a big presence in Los Angeles. And they tried to basically extort him for a ton of cash or stones. And so he was there. I show up. It was supposed to be an 8-hour detail, just literally standing at a guard at his door with another guy. I get there. After an hour of being there, he gets up. He's like, I don't want to be in the hospital anymore. I need to get out of town. And we're like, what? You know, he's like, we're going to San Diego. And so he has us drive him back to his place so he can pack a bag real quick. He gets in, him and his fiance get in their car, and he has us follow in his Bentley convertible.
What's driving. His house like, by the way? Was it just immaculate?
Oh, it was amazing. It was amazing. It was down in Beverly Hills, and it was, you know, it was just a really ostentatious giant mansion. So anyways, like he has this drive, follow him down to San Diego. The guy gets on the freeway, the I-5, and he starts, or, you know, into the 101, and he starts going like 115 miles an hour, just like weaving in and out of cars. I'm like, so we're driving this Bentley with the top down, following him, you know, 100 plus miles down, all the way down to San Diego. And then he puts us up. We go down to La Jolla, he rents out this giant penthouse as part of this nice hotel down there. He gives us our own like penthouse, me and the other bodyguard. And he's like,
wow.
Like, okay. He's like, hang on. I'm like, he's like, and we told him like, hey, we don't have any clothes or anything, you know, like this was supposed to be an 8-hour job. And he's like, well, we're going to be down here for probably a week or something. And I'm like, don't worry. He's like, I'm going to take you guys shopping and stuff. You know, we're going to get you guys all situated. So, you know, he takes us out. So it's like Italian clothing store. I was like just down the road from the place we're staying at. It buys us, you know, I get like $500 Italian dress shirts and stuff. I'm like, what is going on? He takes us out to like the best steakhouse down in La Jolla. We have this amazing meal, and the guy is just a great storyteller. He's telling us all these like crazy stories, and he treats us like his sons. We're down there for a week. I mean, so we're working. We're like standing, you know, guard. You know, but we're hanging out. You know, we're just you know, eating like really fancy dinners and stuff. And I'm like, I come back from that. I'm like, oh my god, bodyguarding might be the best job in the world. But I tell my buddy this, the one who had been doing the bodyguarding for like a year. I tell him what had happened. He's like, what the fuck? He's like, man, I've been doing those for a year, and literally all I do is sit in like a small outhouse in front of my client's home, and like I never do anything. I just sit at a desk. And I'm like, oh really? Like, so this isn't normal. But yeah, I just was fortunate, because from there I got interviewed, I got picked up for Britney Spears. And I was,
so what was that like?
It was, you know, probably as you think it was. so I started working for her right after her breakdown. After the time she shaved her head. And so she was, you know, legally became a ward of her father. So I worked for her father, me and my team. And we were kind of, it was weird because we were kind of babysitters for her. And so that was interesting. I probably can't say too many stories for I ended up becoming her lead. She's actually a very sweet person. Very nice once you get to know her, if she lets you in and stuff like that. And so we became decent friends. You know, like as much as you can, but a lot of stuff that I you know, I could tell you offline, not on a podcast.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I worked for her. You know, I worked for Keith Urban, Nicole Kidman, this billionaire family. So I had like, and like I had some fun stories. I remember sitting in like a drumming circle, some American Idol thing that Keith Urban was performing at, and it was me, him, some of the members of KISS, Will Ferrell, Steve Martin playing the banjo. You know, and I'm just like,
Will Ferrell.
I just ended up like, you know, I just got invited because I think I don't look like a bodyguard, and I never did, and so like people. And I always became, you know, pretty close to a lot of my clients because, you know, I'm just a friendly guy and I just talk to them and stuff. And I'm not one to be, you know, a lot of people got weird around celebrities. I don't care. And so I think because of that, they just, you know, would like bring me in. And so the people would think I'm part of their like inner circle and their friend, their family. And so, you know, I was like, got to go to a lot of weird, really weird, interesting Hollywood parties and all that stuff and just see that whole world, which is a strange world, which is fun to look into, but not a place I'd like to be a part of full time.
Wow, that's just it's fascinating how, you know, someone can see you and what you do now, which is, you know, pretty much all trading and investing. And if they follow you on Twitter, it's like they would have no idea that what you just described happened to you in your life.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's funny because I feel like I've lived a few lives already. You know, right. Just done like really weird stuff. And so I say this stuff and I like, and a lot of stuff gonna happen over 10 years ago, 15 years ago. And I'm like, I have a hard time believing because it's weird, right? Ended up in a lot of weird situations, doing a lot of weird things.
Yeah. I mean, driving, you know, top down in a Bentley going 115 following an Iranian gems dealer is not something many people can say.
Yeah, I guess not.
So then the second part of this kind of two-party question is, you mentioned that you hard coded some things into your strategy after you blew up while you made this $200,000 stake, drew it down 75%. When you were hitting your stride and really hitting those trends, were you benefiting from the fact that you couldn't be at your screen full time and maybe you had some issues like with satellite connections, and so the types of trades you had to do were actually dependent on the job that you had? And the way I'm going to frame this is like Nicholas Darvis in his book, How to Make $2 Million in the Stock Market, mm-hmm. was traveling the world as a ballet dancer, and he couldn't be in front of screens, and he would actually telegram his orders, which is mind-blowing to believe, but we would telegram his orders to his broker. And I think that forced disconnect had more to do with his success than even his technical strategy or even his general psychology. Is what I'm saying similar to the way that you experienced that overseas?
Yeah, I think so. And I think that's still true today. I think it's really important to have something going on outside the market that you're really interested in, because I unless you're an intraday trader, and when you got to be glued to the screens. And I'm not, like, I've done that. I've gone through the whole gambit of, I've tried everything, all these different styles. So I started off, like, when I was working in Afghanistan, I was really into algorithmic trading and building different algos for a number of years. And so I was running a strategy that was partly in algorithmic trading and then partly kind of systematic discretionary. And then being pulled away from the markets, you know, and not being able to watch every tick and every stuff, I just place my orders and let things, you know, go where they may. I think that was really helpful. Because, you know, it's just all you do is you do your process, you place your bets, and then you get your results, you study your results, you make adjustments, you rinse, wash, repeat, right? And so when I came back and I was like, well, I had the opportunity just to focus trading full time, that was very dangerous, because now I had all this time where I'm like, I always got to be making trades, I always got to be getting returns. And still, like, to this day, like, that's why I love having the work to do on MacroOps of just reading and writing and stuff. You know, everything else that goes into, like, running the business, like all the back end, doing the website stuff and talking to clients and everything. That's really helpful, because I'm the type of person who doesn't benefit from watching every tick, you know, throughout the day. And I really enjoy it. So if given the opportunity, I will probably be glued to the screen. Yeah. Right. And so it's nice to have these other things to be able to step away. And I just think it's good to creativity, which I think creativity is really important to trading and investing. You know, so I always try to have, like, different obsessions, little hobbies and stuff that I can really dive into, that, you know, in combination with trading, investing, or else that just, you know, it's just, I think it's good. It flexes the mind and gets you outside of your box. And, you know, maybe mm-hmm. you come away with something, you know, new way to look at, you know, an old thing. Right.
So what were some of these hard coded lessons that you implemented after that big drawdown? You don't have to be specific, but maybe just, you know, in general, like, I will never do this again.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I basically just came up with, first it was a really hard, like, look, period of reflection into my soul and, like, what went wrong. And I think, you know, like, I remember, like, all the greats said, like, Paul Tudor Jones said, like, you won't hire somebody unless he's blown out at least one account, because you have to have felt that pain. And I didn't think this was the case until I went through it a couple times, but now I totally do, is that you have to at one point have felt that pain of really sucking in the markets and being stupid and paying the price for it, because that gives you, it's a scar, it's a battle scar, you know, and so you're not going to forget that. And you know, I took that and I because it wasn't so much that I didn't have a process before. It was that I threw the process out the fucking window. Yeah. And, you know, I let my ego drive, right? Which is never smart. And so that's just, man, after going through that, which at that level for me, which was extremely painful, this is never going to happen again. So, you know, I put it in my process, and like over the years now, it's like, I have zero attachment. There's no revenge trading from me. Yeah. I can at times, if I get, you know, too excited about the market and I don't have other things taking up my time, I will over trade, but I never go against my risk management, you know, take too much risk. Yeah. It's just not in my realm of possibilities anymore.
Yeah. I've seen you flirt with the 1 hour chart, but I don't think I've ever seen you go intraday besides that.
Yeah. Once you see me going 1 hour chart, you know, I have too much time on my hands.
Yeah. Alex is on tilt. If he starts messaging, hey, just went short silver on the 1 hour chart, stop loss above the last tick. All right. Well, let's kind of dive deeper into MacroOps. I mean, obviously this is a podcast about you, and a big part of what you do and kind of who you are is that you've built this awesome platform. And, you know, I was fortunate enough to find you guys. That story is just always fascinating to me, because I think it was year like two or something that you guys were around, that I stumbled on.
Well, it was actually, Brandon, I looked this up the other day, because AK and I were talking, we're like, how long has Brandon been with us? And so I looked up our old email exchange, and this cracked me up. Yeah, this cracked me up, because it's from early 2017.
Yep.
And you're like, hey, you know, I just want to say, like, you know, huge fan of MacroOps. I read you guys like every single morning. You know, totally like changed the way I look at markets. But I bought your, we had this like old like intro to macro course or something that I think Ty and I came put together, you know, back in the day when we were learning how to put together a course. It was like a really intro course. I think we put on a Coursera. It was a piece of crap. And you're like, I bought this course. It was like sold it for $20 or something. And I don't normally do this, but I want to ask for a refund. Not because it wasn't good material, but it was just too basic an intro. And then you said right after that, also, I'm really interested in joining your guys' team as a possible intern. Here's my resume. I'm like, man.
Oh my gosh.
Like, that's a standard Brandon. That takes some balls. you ask for a refund on a product, and then you have to work with us.
Did I legitimately, I'm freaking like, man, I'm glad this isn't I'm glad this isn't video form, because I'm just sitting here like mouth wide open. Did I really say that it was too basic for me? Like, did those words come out of my fingers?
Those were your exact words. It was not that it was bad material, but it was just a little too introductory for me. I mean, it was an intro to macro course, but you had to have your $20 back and then ask to be able to work with us.
I was a broke college junior, and $20 meant a lot to me at the time. Still does, actually. But yeah, so it was, you know, it's one of those things where I found you guys through your Stanley Druckenmiller piece. And mm-hmm. I remember doing the course, and I don't know if it was just because I don't like that part of me at that time in life. Don't remember asking for that refund. Funny how that works. But I do remember asking if I could come on. And I remember Tyler, who you mentioned, TK, Tyler is, you know, he's awesome. And he said, you know, hey man, we'd love to have you. We can't pay you anything, but we would always appreciate another set of hands. And it was literally from that day on. And we've had a 4-year relationship that started because I thought I was too good for the intro course and thought I could give you guys some knowledge with my presence at MacroOps.
Well, I'm pretty sure we made our refund back by bringing you on, like, you know, more than tenfold. So it was a pretty good trade.
I've had a couple good ideas here and there, but all right. So what are you really trying to build here with MacroOps? I know you mentioned the virtual commodities corp, but when you step back and you say, look, you know, in 5 to 10 years, you know, MacroOps is going to be this. And if I had the power to determine exactly what that would be 3 to 5 to 10 years from now, this is what MacroOps would look like. What does that look like? And why should people get excited about it?
Sure. Yeah. So, I mean, I kind of spoke to it a little bit, well, by, you know, the idea of building the virtual commodities corp. But I really want to, I just want to like give the most value to our audience as possible, and keep growing like this, the amazing community that we have, right? Of just like-minded, die-hard fanatics about the market. So whatever that looks like, I think I've been a big fan of Ned Davis type research, and having the quantitative tools and stuff. I think they can be really useful. I also think that they can be very noisy if you get carried away with that stuff. So I like the idea of I've written about this, and you and I have talked about this a bunch, but we're going to be bringing on one or two quantitatively minded traders, investors onto the team here in the coming months. And we're already starting building out, which I hope to release a V1. I already kind of shared some of it with the TL score, but we're gonna be building on that stuff. Just having a really cool internal macro dashboard for our collective with, just like really high signal quantitative tools that we use for, to make informed trading decisions, right? Because I always think the idea of just, melding certain aspects of trying to, because I think when you approach investing, you want to try to quantify as much as possible, but no more, yeah. Right? Einstein said, make it as simple as possible, no simpler. And because if you could fully quantify it, then it's probably going to be arbitraged away, whatever that edge is, unless you're freaking the Medallion
Jim,
Fund or something.
Jim Simons. Over
yeah. Then you have a team of physicists and you're always just coming up with these new, algorithms to deploy in the market. That's obviously not us. But so I like the idea of creating these quantitative tools to inform our objective, unbiased decision-making process as much as we can. I want to build out a lot more capabilities, get that, and then really build out a lot more of the teaching, because we have an amazing group of fund managers, really serious professional traders and stuff, guys from all around the world who are very skilled in different things. So I would love to get more interaction with the community, like you and I talked about. I think later this year we're going to do our first meetup. Yep. Which people have been asking for a long time, which I really want to do. So I think that's definitely on the docket for later in 2021, COVID permitting. And start doing a lot more meetups, getting a lot more interaction and within the group, and just sharing a process. And so we could just, constantly evolve, right? That's our whole ethos, is just continuously evolve, continuously get better, share and build relationships and have a lot of fun doing it. And hopefully provide the best research and actionable theory and stuff that's out there. That's it, I guess, in a nutshell. So, I don't know what exactly that looks like in 5 to 10 years, but I think we just keep on iterating and creating value. Like you and I, we talked about, we're going to be doing hopefully later this year, a travel show.
Yep.
Where
that's going to be
we'll
exciting.
Be, doing a web vlogging series to, I don't know where, we don't know where our first trip is. Maybe it's going to be Japan, because we're still really bullish on Japan. Meeting with company management teams there, maybe some collective members, interviewing some big investors in Japan, doing fun stuff like that. And so, I think that's the path that we have laid out right now.
Yeah. And I think at the end of the day, it is kind of what you said. There's this virtuous cycle happening where every incremental member we add to the collective makes everything better. It's, it's obviously the whole Facebook bull thesis when it started is Facebook as a service gets so much better the more people use it and the more people get added. And it's something as simple as if you and I are trying to red team an idea, or let's say we've got a company we're looking at in a space where one of our collective members recently sold a company that he started in that industry, and he's got connections in that space. He knows it in and out. He built a business, he sold a business. He knows what's good, what's not, what products work, what products suck. And it's just so awesome to be able to be able to democratize that process where it's saying, hey, look, I'm researching X. anyone out there familiar with this product, use it, understand it. And you'll have guys, it's usually, you know, two to four people that are like, hey, I use it. The company that I run uses it. Or, hey, you know, I recently sold my business. We worked in this space. Like, to me, that's what's cool about it.
Oh, it's amazing, right? I mean, you just get access to intelligence that you would never have otherwise, right? So yeah, that's my favorite part of this whole thing, man. It's just the group that we have.
I mean, even Malaysia is a perfect example. So I went on a 3-week tangent trying to find really cool Malaysian ideas. And I could probably go 6 months and find a new idea every week in Malaysia. And I would email. So every Wednesday I send out, you know, this one write-up where it's like, hey, this is what I've looked at. And each time I've done that for Malaysia, I've had people come back and say, oh, hey, look, I'm a PM in Malaysia and it's actually one of my biggest holdings. Or, hey, look, I used to run a fund out in Malaysia. Or, I'm a family office and we've got assets in Malaysia. It's like, oh my gosh. Like, Think about it as like Twitter on steroids, where you're interacting with these people that are boots on the ground. And now you don't need analysts, you don't need a team of analysts because you got one right there. It's like, oh, you live in Malaysia. Oh, you used to do business in Malaysia. That's perfect. Let me hop on a call with you. And then you're good.
Oh, it's dude. I mean, it's amazing. And what the internet's allowed us to do is just wild, you know. And then what we've done with MacRops, it's like, you know, I have a couple of my idols, investing idols, you know, are in our group, right? And that's just like mind blowing. I never would have thought that we'd be there, you know, and that to be able to have can be connected to these type of people, be able to talk to them and stuff and reach out to them. That's something else.
Yeah. And, you know, with that said, one of the things we pride ourselves on, which you mentioned earlier, is this radical transparency. And one of the reasons that you started MacRops, one of the reasons that I joined, is that so many newsletters out there. I mean, you can see it with Raging Bull and what happened over there with all the court documents that come out and basically showing what everyone thought was the case. But
I was blown away, man. I mean, so they weren't really making $1 million option trades from their private jets. Like, what?
The best part is they roped in Damon John from Shark Tank and did a commercial with him or something, and Damon John was like, I'm so glad I found these guys because now I've taken my trading to a whole new level.
Oh, man, God.
Like, this man's on Shark Tank, CNBC. Yeah.
No, oh man, just no moral compass. That's horrible.
Yeah, but you know, around that, one of the things that we hated about how traditional newsletters work is that they either just spray ideas every week with no accountability, or there's no, you know, way to track their actual performance. And what we do at MacRops, it's, you know, we're trading our own money and we're trading a portfolio that is exactly how we would trade the markets, the good and the bad and the misses and the not misses. And
to add on to that is, yeah, it's like a pick is meaningless. To say, oh, hey, I'm bullish on this company, that tells me nothing.
Yeah, it's, you know, like, do you own it?
Well, what's your conviction? You know, what's your bet sizing? What's your uncle point? When are you gonna start taking profits? It's like, man, the whole newsletter industry is just it's infotainment, right? And it's not good. It's not conducive to being profitable in this game because it teaches a bunch of bad habits. Like, one, that picks really matter. I mean, that's maybe 20% of the game. Yeah. Where 80% is position sizing, risk management, you know, how that all interacts in a portfolio and stuff. And so, like, you know, I mean, that's something that we do differently, is that, you know, we include all that stuff in real time. Like, here's how much we're putting in, you know, here's our sizing, here's our risk, you know, stop, here's where we take, you know, where we're going to be taking, you know, profits and stuff. And, you know, like that's what we're rolling out, a, you know, a tracking portfolio that's going to be linked up to Fund Seeder. And, you know, starting hopefully by the end of this month, mid February at the latest, we're going to have a real live portfolio that, you know, is a tracking portfolio of our internal portfolio. And so people can see our returns, and, you know, all that stuff in real time. Cause I think that's really important, because, most people are, the space is filled with snake oil salesmen and stuff. And so, I think you have to, we want to be as transparent with everything as possible, right?
Yeah. And it's also interesting to, be running a newsletter at this time when, or, you know, even just a research service when it's so easy to pat yourself on the back or to highlight how many times you've gotten it right, when in actuality, and I was actually having this conversation with a good friend of mine who runs a fund, and, you know, I was talking to him about the year we've had, and we'll get into the returns and stuff. And I'm like, yeah, it's good. And yeah, there's a lot of things we could have done better, which we'll also talk about. But at the same time, I'm like, in a market like this, I just don't know what is my personal skill, what is your personal skill, and what is just sheer trend and luck. And I don't know if that feeling, if that doubt is ever going to go away. And I know that there's some good and bad to that, but you know, I just don't know if you want to touch on that really, because it seems like a lot of people are going around, you know, parading their returns, parading all the picks they've got right. But at the end of the day, it's like, you know, you should be judged on the time frame that your strategy should be judged on, whether you do really well or whether you do really bad. And I just don't think I'm comfortable enough to say that the returns we had this year were because we're just so smart. Or because we just, you know, maybe
that's a dangerous thing to confound a bull market with, you know, trading investing skill. And I, as a discretionary trader investor, you don't ever want to lose that worry, right? Because there, you know, I mean, who's to say, depending, you know, especially if you're a long-term investor, like you could invest for 20 years and still not 100% sure of how much of your record is due to skill. You know, and so, you know, unless you're a systematic trader and you can backtest this stuff and you know, the expectancy of your different styles and everything, like, then you can more with more confidence say, you know, this is my edge, this is my skill. And the more you move to longer term discretionary stuff, the more variables are involved, the more randomness. And it's impossible ever to say, like, I'd like to think that we have generated alpha due to our skill, you know, but this year has been,
me too.
Right. Yeah. But I also don't ever want to, I think it's just really important to stay humble because, you know, I always consider myself a beginner and I definitely am. Like, I'm a beginner in this game. I think I'm always going to be a beginner because there's just too much to learn. And so, you know, talk to me in 15 years, I'm going to be like, man, I'm an idiot. You know, because like the way I look at it is every 6 months I go through this like mulching process where if I look back on me from 6 months ago and I don't think like, oh my God, I'm embarrassed. What an idiot. Like the things I thought I knew, my beliefs, you know, certain like things that I did in the market. And if I don't think that means I'm not growing fast enough. You know, so that's like a good like heuristic that I run through, because if I look back, I'm like, oh yeah, I was like, man, I was like stellar, crushing it. I was really good. You know, then I know I'm getting lazy and I'm resting on my laurels and somebody's going to come and eat my lunch eventually. So, I mean, it's just one of those funny things, but I just think it's super important just to, you know, especially when you're a discretionary trader or investor, you just got to really stay humble and focus on the process. Try to get in as many reps, like doing the things that like you and I do, like through case studies and stuff. And, you know, so you get all these hypothetical reps in as much as possible, you know, studying the past, you know, it's never going to be a perfect analog, but you can port over a lot of tools and, you know, and then hopefully you could, you know, kind of start building your confidence and like, okay, what is the skill? And, you know, if you string together years and years and years and years of a good consistent track record, then you could say, okay, well, I probably at least generated some bit of alpha there and, you know, maybe a lot of luck too.
Yeah, well, I think also the other issue about this luck versus skill, and obviously anytime I think about this, I think of Michael Mobison, and he's got a great Google talk on that, which I'll link to in the show notes, just about luck versus skill. More so, he relates it to sports, and I think the reason why sports is so easy to kind of put this luck versus skill paradox into contention is you can physically see when something is luck versus when something is skill. For instance, if I'm playing tennis and I am even with somebody and I hit a shot and it hits the top of the net and barely bounces over, that's luck. That's not skill. Like, I'm not trying to hit that top of the tape and have it roll over. And you can see that in sports, you know, whether it's basketball where you do a, you know, shot from 3/4 of the way, you know, of the way down and it goes in. Like, that's not, you know, there's some skill, but that's mostly luck. the problem with investing, I think, is that it's not that highlight reel type thing where, you know, at most we're just order enterers that have a hypothesis about something that may or may not be right. It's not like we're going in for a layup or we're trying to heave a basketball from half court. You know what I mean?
Yeah. No, that's really well said. Yeah, I feel like Michael Mabuson's kind of learned everything that then we all spend, you know, 20, 30 years of just learning stuff and we're like, oh, this is new. And then you read, you know, his stuff and you're like, okay,
he's already written about it,
you know, 100 times. He's written all these papers and that's definitely true. Yeah.
Do you think going back to your question on malting every 6 months, do you think that that's something that's innate and can't be trained? Or do you think that that's something that can be trained? I guess it's the nature versus nurture type question.
Yeah, I think it can be. I think some people are naturally kind of, that's just what they're more geared towards. You know, but yeah, I think it definitely can be trained. Like in any area, if somebody has a passion about really getting good at a certain thing, and it's for the right reasons to get good, not for like status. I think a lot of people do things for status. I think we're all, you know, driven by Girardian, mimetic desires, right, to imitate others. And that is especially true in markets and trading investing. I mean, you see that, I see that. I've, you know, talked to so many professionals, guys who run even like really big funds, and they don't know that much about the game, like really, like at a deep level, at a true level. They sound really smart, very intelligent, you know, which is how they raise so much money. They went to a good schools and stuff. And they, you know, say all that, but I feel like after really talking to these guys, and this started to blow me away when I first, you know, started getting access to a lot of these people, because I was just a nobody who just reads a lot of books. But you realize a lot of people just like spout Buffettisms, you know, and they try to mimic what they think Charlie Munger would say or do in that situation. But it's like, that's the thing, like Warren Buffett, Charlie Munger, Stanley Druckenmiller, George Soros, like those guys are who they are, not because they're trying to mimic other people, but because they are so driven to be good at the game that they've taken their ego out of it. And they are just like maniacally focused on getting better, not on imitating anybody. And that's why they're Buffett. That's why they're Soros, right? And so it's a really tough thing because we're all driven by this, you know, innate mimetic desire to imitate others and people we idolize and stuff like that. You know, I know I am. You have to know that about yourself, right? And so it's just interesting because it can lead, because a lot of things that people say, you know, can be taken out of context and you study it and then that becomes part of your, you know, internal Bible and how to think about that stuff. And maybe it wasn't even, you're not even thinking about it in the right context. Or maybe, you know, that's something they just said off the cuffs, or it doesn't fit into, you know, a broader structure that even applies to you. So it's just meaningless and it could be, you know, a negative expected value. And so that's why it's just really important to like, to go through this process if you're really driven by a desire to get good at something. For the right reasons, not for status or appearance, but just because you love the game and you want to master it. Then you're going to go through what's necessary because you're not going to let your ego get in the way, because it's not about the ego, right? It's just about the art.
Yeah. So then I guess this is coming off of me just listening to Monish Pabrai's latest podcast on value investing with legends. And one of the things I've wrestled with him, and it's not, this is not to say that what he's saying is wrong or, you know, that this is bad or not, but he is a very big proponent of cloning, you know, being a shameless cloner is kind of what he likes to say about Charlie and Warren, you know, like what would Charlie do? What would Warren do? Where does that line end between cloning, like acceptable cloning, and then like, all right, man, or all right, you know, girl, like you gotta find your own style. Like you can only clone, I guess, to a certain point before each incremental effort to clone actually produces less returns, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Well, there's a couple ways to look at it. Like one, you know, it's like 13F reports come out at a lag, right? So you're not even getting that information. So they could be in that position for a long time, and it's only, you know, showing certain sides of their portfolio. So they could have a lot of different option structures or derivative plays, and then make, you know, what could seem like a long in a certain company actually part of a larger short position or something that's, you know, trying to bounce.
Right.
So there's that aspect, but when it comes to like you know, cloning in the sense that Provide uses it. I actually think there's nothing wrong with it. I think for me, I know when I first started out and I would like, I was just dead set on trying to be a contrarian. And I didn't even know what that meant, but it just meant like disagreeing with everybody. Yeah. And so like, I would, you know, look at all these, you know, other positions that smart people smarter than me were buying. And I'd be like, well, shoot, that actually sounds really good, but I can't buy it now because this guy recommended it to me and it has to be my idea. And that stuck with me for a long time.
That's a big struggle.
Yeah, it really is. I think a lot of people initially go through that. Now I shamelessly will steal ideas from people. But the difference is I'm not cloning them like blindly. That's like, dude, it's like if the world is your analyst and you know smart people, and you respect their work, you know, you know them personally, or you follow them long enough and you read their work and you're like, okay, this guy gets it. And he, you know, you can use them basically as your own virtual analyst, right? Like, yeah. Why wouldn't you? Because there's a big world out there with a lot of opportunities. So you got to find some ways to filter these things down. And running certain stock screens isn't like a great process most of the time because it's, you know, it goes back to that quantitative thing. Anything that can't be quantitative, fully quantitative, it's going to be fully arbitraged away eventually, right? And so using finding your own analyst, which is something I've done for years now, as like a one way to filter out opportunities, not your only way. And then you use that and you're like, okay, well, that's an interesting idea. You know, you read some of that stuff. I'm going to dive deeper into that and see if it makes sense to me or if it fits in my process, right? And so I'll clone in that sense. It's not like never a full clone because, you know, that's not what we do. But like you and I will shamelessly steal from other people.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah, because it's great because, you know, they're just part of our analyst network and we'll be like, okay, this seems like a really interesting idea. Let's dig into this and do our own work, right? That's a first filter. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I think we cloned Roku from Scott Miller, maybe.
Probably, yeah. Probably.
And you know, that turned out to be one of our biggest mistakes because we didn't bet big enough and we didn't hold long enough. So
I know. We didn't clone him hard enough.
We didn't clone him hard enough. So yeah. I think that's a great segue into our returns and kind of what went right and what went wrong, and we'll, you know, just end on this discussion. So why don't you walk us through the 2020 returns, what we did right, and you know, we both can touch on kind of what went wrong. I know I've got some things that I really wish you know, I would have done better, some things I'm excited to get better at for next year. And I'll kind of let you take care of it from there.
Sure. Yeah. So I don't have the numbers directly in front of me, but you know, I think we did 66% on the year. I believe we had our largest drawdown was in the 14-ish% range.
Yeah, 14.13.
I think we had one drawdown around 14%, and then another that was, I don't know, around 12% or something. So all in all, like numbers wise, a decent year. It's a decent year, especially for the way we manage the portfolio, which is pretty conservatively. You know, we don't take large position sizes. We're really tight with our risk. But I end up giving our total performance a B-. I feel like that's the right grade for where we are. And especially for me personally, I think you crushed this year. I think this was your best year. So I would give you a higher grade. I put you at a B+ or A-, Brandon. Well deserved. Me, not so much. I'm borderline C+. Because there's a number of things that I didn't like about the way I performed, just looking back. And I wrote about this in the piece, like when you do these reviews, one, it's like a really good process and people, you should be studying your trading journal monthly, if not, then quarterly or something like that. And that's the highest return, I think, exercise that we do. And it's just so important to take detailed notes on your decision-making at the time, because there's a lot of biases looking in hindsight, you know, with resulting and stuff being like, oh, well, this was a winner and because I did all these right things, you know. I did a number of things wrong. One was I sold Grow Generation Corp.
I know you're smiling right now, but it's just so cringe.
Being a 1900% return in 12 months, and I sold it, you know, for a loss of 50 basis points, and then it ran like 2 months after I sold. So looking back, because like one of the great things about what we do is, you know, since we write constantly about the markets, you know, and then I have my own trading journal, I have extensive notes on everything. So I get to see my decision-making process through the year. So starting in January, I was slow discounting the COVID thing. One that's partly by just my process is that I look at news from a market, from an investing standpoint, as just like, okay, well, how does this fit into the narrative? And how does that narrative then fit into positioning? That's really from that, like, sense, that's the only like way, the lens I look at it when I'm trying to play the right markets, because it's easy to get caught up in these narratives and then you make mistakes. But I was looking at the market in February, starting in mid-February, and I was writing about how extremely stretched it was. It was overpositioned. We were due for, you know, 15% plus sell-off. You know, so that was right. And then starting late February, I started writing about, okay, this COVID narrative scares really picking up. This could be a real, you know, real event. So a little bit behind the curve on there, but from a trading standpoint, you know, we flattened the book, you know, by the February 24th, 25th, and then we were 200%, 250% long bonds, right? So you couldn't have better positioning. So when the market was down, you know, come early March or whatever, down 30 something percent, we were up 20 something percent. So we dodged the bullet, you know, but like the process itself, we had a negative, you know, trifecta lens score, you know, bull vol.
So talk to us, talk to us about that trifecta lens score just from a high level, because I know that's kind of proprietary to what we kind of do, but from a high level, is it just what high signal, low noise gives you one round number on what?
Yeah, so it's just part of our effort to further quantify the process, right? So I look at, I have a big dashboard of things that I look at, and I've been working on just narrowing, filtering those down to just essentials, because I don't want to look at 100 different indicators. I want to look at a few high signal ones, but ones that look at the market from a different perspective, right? So the TL score is it's a grouping, a batch of indicators that look at different areas of the market. So breadth, sentiment, positioning, liquidity. And within that, it looks at it from each, you know, looks at liquidity from different angles, looks at breadth from different angles. And so, because, you know, there's no perfect indicator, no indicator is going to give you a perfect score in time, but if you have the right high signal indicators, and you look at them holistically, well, you know, so essentially the TL score is an aggregation of that. And a positive score is positive, the more positive, the more, you know, more positive for the market, and vice versa. And so it has a tends to have a strong lead on price action, right? So by the time, you know, February, the top came in, which was like February 22nd or something like that, you know, our TL score was the giving a negative six reading, which was the lowest score that it has had all year, and had given one of those 2 weeks prior to that. So we already had warning signals, like we knew something big was coming. So the, you know, I still at that time, I didn't know it was going to be a 30 plus percent. Like that still surprised me. Right. But like, it didn't matter. We knew to be bearish, so we flattened our book and we went extremely long bonds.
We also went short Boeing.
Oh, and then
we can't forget the short Boeing.
Yeah, that ended up being a big trade. Yeah. I don't know how much we made. That was amazing. It was a good chunk.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, we made, yeah. So we made out, and then, I think my weakest trading for the year followed in the weeks around the bottom of March. I got a little too active when I should have just, I mean, it was just crazy, right? I should have gone on vacation, let the dust settle, kept the positions off. I was still trying to, you know, get position short and get position long. You know, it was stupid. Because when the market's that messy, you're better off not trading. I don't know, unless you're like a vol trader and stuff, and you're probably having a field day. And so that was probably, that was most definitely my weakest part. Yeah, I mean, and so for like my calls, like I think like on March 25th, 2 days after the bottom, you know, I put out a piece, you know, like, well, you know, saying the bull's saving March, you know, and saying that we've probably put in at least an interim bottom. And that ended up obviously being the right call. I was still a little too gingerly in getting back in long. But by, you know, we started just correcting that because, you know, we follow the tape and stuff, and with the amount of stimulus and everything, I personally felt like I was still too affected by the bearish narrative. But luckily I had my process and the tape was telling me this, my indicators were telling me this, so we started buying, we started, you know, getting into stuff. I think our biggest mistakes this year because really with our calls and the things that we got in, we should have been up 150%, you know.
I agree.
Or more. And that's not like, you know, it's not like, that's not maybe close to bragging. It's actually just saying like, we did a kind of a shitty job compared to like how right we got things. And the opportunity set that was 2020. I mean, it was an amazing trading investing environment that was just perfect for our style and our process. And so we didn't take full advantage of that. A number of things that we did really poorly, I feel like that we were going to improve on is we got in some great trades around the bottom, but we kept our stops too light. And we should have positioned size better and put the risk on better according to the volatility of the market, widen those stops, give them room to run. I mean, things like Nautilus, Bed Bath & Beyond come to mind.
Bed Bath and Beyond. I don't even want to think about that mistake.
No, there's so many plays I don't want to think about.
Shoot, that's another cloner, because it was Super Magatu. We cloned his original thesis on that one,
yeah,
right?
It was a great thesis.
Yep.
I just felt like we kind of mismanaged it. And then the things that we did have like super high conviction on, like Bitcoin, that's like one thing. So I've really noticed about myself. I've noticed it for a long time, but it's became really apparent this last year, is that I trade my personal portfolio. One, like I'm a lot more active and aggressive, and like I put stuff on, I get out, I put stuff on. We have to by nature do that differently for the collective portfolio, because you know, a lot of our clients are big funds or institutions, and it would just be spamming their inboxes if we're getting in and getting out, you know, five times a day.
And their sizes to the point where if they're actually, you know, following what we do, right, they can't just get in and get out without making a market.
Yeah. And so, one of the things that I noticed is that I hesitate on the trigger too much. Like when, you know, I started writing about Bitcoin back in June, or July, when I was like formed this perfect wedge that was really bullish on the macro case. And I'm like, hey, like you, and I was telling people, you should be backing up the truck on this thing. We personally didn't back up the truck, and there was no reason. We were just like, you know, there's always stuff going on. And, I noticed that I don't like to be wrong, in front of an audience. You know, and that's hard when you run a newsletter, and that's a really bad thing to have, because that's my ego then getting into the driver's seat.
It's funny you mentioned that, and sorry to cut you off, but I think this is important, is that from a value investor's perspective, right, where you know have this big grandiose thesis, and it's not like reading the tape, right? Because you can read you can read the tape, you can see the chart, and if it, you know, hits your stop and the chart pattern fails, like, all right, whatever, you know, you move on to the next trade, it's easier. And one of the things I've noticed, and I don't know if it's because of the amount of ideas that I think are out there, one of the things I did well this year was not have that hesitation and not be afraid to look wrong. Because in my eyes, if you manage risk properly and you understand portfolio construction, it doesn't matter if your next idea is wrong. It doesn't matter if your next, you know, three or four ideas are wrong. If you let probabilities work out, and if you manage risk and you size appropriately, and you know, you buy things that you think are at crazy discounts, one of them are going to work. And if three of them don't work, you're fine. And I just don't know if that's because I think there's so many ideas out there that I'm okay with writing about one and buying one that doesn't work out, because it's always on to the next one. I would like to think it's that.
Well, that's the right mindset to have, right? I noticed that in myself, that it was just I was being hesitant on pulling the trigger on like high conviction things. You know, and this isn't resulting on my part, because like I said, I go back and I read my stuff, my journal and everything, and so. You know, we luckily got into Bitcoin in October when it broke out of the wedge, but even still not in the size that I wish. It was one of our biggest winners of the year, but not in the size that matched my conviction level at the time. And we should have gotten in a couple months earlier. Yeah. You know, you say the same thing about Micron. Like, I studied the crap out of that play. It was my highest conviction thing of the entire year. And still, we bought .ims, I think, 1.5% position.
So we bought, it was like 1.5 at $1.38 per contract. And at the time we were, and this is what's frustrating. This is why I'm glad we're having this conversation, because at the time we're still up we're still up nice. And it's one of those things where Druckenmiller's always talked about this too, where he says if he's up big, he's revving it up, he's pushing it because he knows he's got a hot hand. And yeah, if he's got the hot hand, he can create a banner year. And we only sized it like 1-1.5% position, where looking back on it, why couldn't have that been a 3 or 4%? Because we were up 30-40% at the time on the year.
Yeah. Oh, I know. And I mean, it should have been, even though, like, to think of that, if we would have sized it at 3-4%, the profits on that thing right now.
I don't like to think about it, because we wouldn't be on this podcast. We'd be chilling on a yacht right now.
Yeah. The portfolio volatility that we'd have. Oh my God. I would not know what to do with that thing. Cause it's been a beast, but, yeah, I mean, we really should have. And, you know, part of that, like, so I'm like thinking of ways to put in place. I mean, one of the reasons was I hated sending out trade alert emails because I hate Entreport, which is our CRM. And so I wasn't as active in sending stuff out and getting into things. I think, you know, probably that. Well, and also it's like, you know, like I take, like, this is a huge responsibility because I know we have a lot of members that follow us into trades. You know, or at least like use us as a basis, right, for their own process. And so I don't want, you know, even though, like, personally, I have no problem losing money. Like, I love losing. I take losses. It doesn't bother me. It hasn't bothered me for years. But yeah, it's just really interesting because I trade, like, you know, managing money, other people's money. And so you notice like a change in your psyche. And so I got some work on that, put in like processes and stuff, you know, so we don't, so that's not going to be a limiting factor going into the future. And I don't think it's going to be, because I'm pretty dead set on not letting that hold me back. Cause I want to be in Bitcoin in June, you know, versus October. So
yeah. Alex is like, why send out a 4-bagger alert? Because I hate Entreport, and that's how much I hate it. I'm going to withhold a 4-bagger.
But... Well, anybody who's spent any amount of time in Entreport would actually sympathize with that take.
What's that? Yeah. And I wonder if this is something where we end up hard coding into our process, where it's like, okay, if we're X amount over our internal hurdle rate or whatever, because, you know, we're in this for absolute returns. I mean, I think anybody that does this game to not try to be the greatest trader and investor of all time, I just don't know if you're going to have the staying power. Like, it's not, you know, like, I don't want to sit here and be like, oh, you're not going to have what it takes. It's like, that's not really what it's about. It's like, if you really love this game and you want to be the best and you want to go down as one of the best, like, that's the only way to play it. Because if you're wrong, it doesn't matter. But if you're right, it's life changing. And, you know, you go out and do something that no one ever thought could be done.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wonder if it's
exactly. Yeah. Well, I mean, like, when you get a fat pitch, you got to swing for the fences, and because they only come around ever so often. Right. Yeah. And then you got to know when you can, you know, step on the pedal and when you can't. And so that's actually something I'm working on. I hope to get a report out soon. You know, I've been talking to a couple of members about it. And so I'm a little bit behind in getting it out, but like my next big project, ever since I got out the TL score, is working on quantifying market regimes. Like, you know, we use the SQN indicator, which is awesome, amazing indicator, but it's also kind of lagging in short term, where I'm thinking more of like as a long-term positional trader. If you look at markets, the ebb and flow of like market, long-term market trends, you know, there's, you know, buy points that last weeks to months. And then there's, you know, parts to lighten up on your aggressive buying. And then there's parts to like start paring back risk and times to start hedging risk, right? And so if you can like effectively quantify a lot of those into certain market regimes, zones or whatever, then you know, like you can act with more confidence. And a more higher, you know, positive statistical edge on when to buy aggressively in a broader macro environment, right? So then you can, you know, not only find a great, you know, stock company that you really like, but you can buy it with more size, buy it more aggressively, because you know you're aligning, you know, these, you know, the micro with the macro and the, you know, whatever time frames and stuff. Mm-hmm. And so that's something I'm really excited about, but I still have some more work to do on it. So hopefully get it out soon.
Yeah. And I think moving on to, you know, kind of what we did right overall was risk management. And I mm-hmm. think, you know, that was shown in the drawdown and just being able to have that flexibility to, you know, hedge some of the stuff by going short. You know, no one would have expected how fast and far Boeing fell, but like, again, that goes back to luck versus skill. It's like, yeah, sure, you can say that we had the SQN indicators and we got our trend, you know, the trifecta score, but it's like, I mean, that seems like a three quarters of a basketball court shot that just happened to go in, you know?
Yeah. And as an investor, you just gotta be happy to take it, you know, because it's great to be lucky, you know?
Yep. Yeah. And I think, so I want to wrap up at least the review with kind of the two areas that I personally did really poorly on. I think from an analytical perspective, the ideas that I brought forth during the year were pretty decent, but the fact of the matter is we didn't capitalize the way we should have. And so, you know, the first one is Ammo Inc. And we were lucky enough to get into this one fairly early, and I'm not going to get into the thesis too much here because we're almost going on 2 hours anyways. But if anybody wants it, you know, just reach out to me on Twitter. I can send you a thesis now because the company's gaining so much popularity. At the time we were writing, no one was covering it. So I wanted to keep it under the radar just for our collective people. And it actually got some people upset because I would tease out on Twitter, like, I can't believe a company that's projected to grow revenues 300% was down 4% on an earnings call or something like that. And So here was a name where we were writing about it at like 170, 180. I thought it was a $10 to $12 stock in the next 12 to 18 months, and had a pretty decent, you know, bet that it was going to be that. And we still didn't size it properly. We sized it fairly small at the beginning, and it grew into a large position, and we ended up adding again at a time that I think was lucky, because we ended up adding around $3 or so. And then a few weeks after that, the stock just, it must have hit the Reddit Wall Street Bets community and went straight to the moon. Yeah. And
it was a great find. Yeah. And I was thinking about that, because looking back at the time, you and I kept digging into the company, trying to find red flags, seeing where we were wrong. Cause you were like, that was, you know, you were found that on the OTC list and you couldn't find that anywhere. Like, it was just totally under the radar, but really compelling thesis, amazing management team, strong growth, you know, moving into a really sleepy industry, and had some incredibly fascinating IP. And so, yeah, we had tons of high conviction on it. And we went in small because it was, you know, tiny OTC, and it was just really illiquid. So that,
I mean, there are also definitely some real risks, though. Like, the balance sheet wasn't tremendous. They had to do some share issuances.
Uh-huh.
They're basically operating over capacity. There was a major lag between what they could produce given their resources and what they needed to spend in order to reach a capacity that they could actually sustain those revenues. So it wasn't, you know, they were burning cash, and you know, like, the founder was also, you know, loaning the company money at like super low, basically helping the company by giving him, you know, by giving the business some more cash. So it wasn't, you know, one of these like hidden gems where it was 50% EBIT margins growing at 50%. And I don't know if that maybe played into the position sizing, to be honest. Like, I was just so concerned about those downsides that I didn't feel comfortable, you know, sizing up to like 5 to 8% position from cost.
I wouldn't say that was a totally mismanaged one. I think we could have been more aggressive in building up that position size once, you know, especially once it got listed on the NASDAQ. And
as it was working too, that's my thing. And Ian Castle always talks about this, where he says, you know, you should always look to be adding to your winners. And what we should have done is, after literally every press release where they're like, hey, look, we're working 24/7. We can't, there's so much demand. We're expanding into stores. Yeah. We're growing our distribution.
Blowing out their already super strong forward guidance.
Yeah. And like, every single time that they did that, we should have been incrementally buying shares, which is something that I want to get better at next year. And then, same sort of style was Roku. You and I both were really bullish on that. I read Scott's piece and I was like, this makes sense. I really like the platform idea. You know, this whole kind of, you know, it's not a hardware company, it's a software company type spin on it, but we didn't size it big enough. And as it continued to do well, we weren't adding because we're like, oh, we'll just wait for a retrace. And Roku never retraced for us ever.
No, son of a bitch. just kept going up.
And we also did that. We also did that with Nintendo too. That was another one of our highest conviction ideas.
God, man, done it. That one really sickens me because we were just so slow to add to it. And yet, like, so some of our position sizing was just really off because we were slow to add to these really high conviction names that were had a lot of margin of safety built into their price. And yet we had carried large positions in these like more speculative names that were, you know, maybe strong conviction, but not the same level and definitely not the same margin of safety.
Yeah.
So we had somewhat of an upside down portfolio there for a while.
I know. That's why I'm sitting here thinking like 66%. It's like, yes, but man, did we leave a lot of chips on the table?
We did. We definitely did.
So, all right. So going into 2021, what is the one thing that, you know, we're in our fifth year as a business, and officially MacroOps has kind of catapulted that hurdle of 80%. I guess it's like 80% of businesses fail after 5 years or something like that. So,
so
we made it. And looking forward now, what's kind of the most exciting thing about this sixth year at MacroOps that gets you, you know, excited to wake up every day?
Oh man, it's too many to count. Like we've talked about them. I'm really excited about doing in-person meetups with our community because the guys been wanting it. We have I've been able to lucky enough to meet a lot of our members in person now, have lunch with them and stuff, grab drinks, and they're just awesome. Like so much like the depth of experience. So I really want to bring all these people together, and that's gonna be a lot of fun. So there's that. You know, building up the dashboard, I'm really excited about what we're doing with that. Doing our travel show, man, I can't wait. That's going to be
I can't
so
wait
fun.
For that.
Yeah, that's going to be awesome. Well, you and I, you know, we're getting a fund set up. So we'll be getting that going. That's super exciting. I'm trading in the World Trading Championship this year.
That's right.
I'm about to write a piece on. Yeah, I'm getting it started, obviously, January 1st, and I'm just getting set up, so I won't be probably start training until February 1st. So I'm a little bit behind, but.
Well, you're giving everybody else a head start because they need it, right?
Being nice. Yeah. So this is my second attempt. This is just kind of they're silly little contests, but ever since reading about Marty Schwartz winning one of these, it's always been on my bucket list. I competed once, I think, gosh, I don't know how long ago, 7 years ago or something. And I was in the top five for the first, a few months, and then I blew up. We'll see how this year goes.
Awesome. All right. Well, you're not getting away without me asking you the question I ask every guest. So if you could have dinner with one person from the past or the present, who would it be and why?
Oh man.
Yeah.
Shoot, I wish you would have told me that beforehand.
I wish you would have listened to more of my episodes.
all right.
And then so Alex is like, I wish you would have had me on earlier. And to that I say fair.
All right. So living or dead, huh?
Yep. It doesn't have to be finance related, and it can't be Britney Spears because you guys are already good friends.
Oh God, I would not want to have dinner with her anyways. Let's see. I would, for me, I mean, it wouldn't be finance related. So I'm really interested in one of my new hobbies or my obsessions is studying the ancient Vedic, wise men from India, 5,000 years ago, the people who wrote the Upanishads and stuff. They're just like the wisdom blows me away. So I would love to be able to meet one of those people because it's a lost art. It's starting, it's been preserved in some places like held secret. I mean, talking about performance hackers and stuff like Silicon Valley bros think that they're, cutting edge, because they learned some like Wim Hof breathing exercises. Like, man, that's like nothing new. Like that's a tiny little part of something that these guys were doing 5,000 years ago. And they learned how to hack the body and the mind and the nervous system at a level that you can't even fathom. And so I am obsessed with Kundalini yoga.
What is that for lay people?
We'd have to do a full episode on that, but it's not yoga as in the sense of like what we think of as, women wearing Lululemon pants and doing
downward dogs. Yeah.
This is traditional, like old school and Kundalini tantric yoga, which is tantric is not a sex position. It means technology basically. So it's using your body as a technology to attain certain outcomes. And so Kundalini yoga is it's based around this a certain energy in the body that you can cultivate by, you know, doing certain concentration meditations and working your body in certain ways to attain interesting outcomes. That's all I guess I'll say. So I would love.
You have titillated my fascination.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's my obsession, man. So my girlfriend makes fun of me because I get a new Kundalini book like every day off Amazon, and I probably have 30 now. And so I've been, you know, practicing this stuff, you know, sometimes a couple hours a day for the last, I don't know, 9 months. If anybody has never read the Upanishads, I highly suggest doing so. It's my all-time favorite book. It's got the most wisdom packed into, a relatively small book that, out of anything I've ever read. It's beautiful. And so it's something that awesome. I reread constantly. So I would love to meet one of those old wise men.
Awesome. Well, I can't think of a better way to end the show. Alex, my partner in crime at Macrops, I'm excited for what we got in store in 2021. And I'm glad people can finally get a chance to listen to your story and hear some of your awesome experiences throughout life. And I know the people are going to love this one.
Hey, Brandon, it was a blast being here, dude. I had a lot of fun. We'll have to do this again in like a year or something.